Welcome to Boston University's World of Ideas. I'm Ted O'Brien. Tonight we bring you the latest lecture by Nobel laureate Amartya Sen. Professor Sen is Boston University's first visiting professor at the Frederick S. Pardee Center for the Study of the Longer Range Future. During this academic year, Professor Sen is delivering a series of lectures on the future of identity, in which he attempts to explore the questions that arise from the way people define themselves in terms of group membership, especially at a time of increasing globalization. Professor Sen won the Nobel Prize in Economics in 1998 for his contributions to welfare economics in the areas of social choice, welfare distributions, and poverty. Tonight's lecture is entitled Identity and Culture. Here now is Professor Amartya Sen.
Today's talk, which continuously it's the third lecture, is on culture and identity. So I will get on to that subject without further introduction to remind you that I had previous discussions dealing with the idea of identity was the first one, and the second was on globalization. And I'm particularly concerned with the issue of culture in this lecture. Many years ago, when I was an undergraduate at Cambridge, one of my teachers, Joan Robinson, a great professor of economics, told me during a particularly argumentative tutorial, I quote her, "Let me tell you about the Japanese, the Indian, and the Chinese. The Japanese are much too polite. You Indians are much too rude. The Chinese are just right." I accepted this generalization readily, since the alternative would have been to provide further evidence of the Indian propensity towards rudeness. But I also did recognize that no matter what I did, the imaging would not quickly change in my teacher's mind. Joan Robinson, by the way, was very fond of Indians in general. She thought they were quite okay in a rude kind of way. Cultural generalizations have great power in fixing our way of thinking. Sometimes they also have considerable perspicacity. There can be little doubt that our cultural background can have quite a major influence on our behavior and thinking, and also the quality of life that we enjoy and the identities that we value cannot but be influenced by our cultural background. It can also influence our sense of perception of affiliation with groups of which we see ourselves as members. That culture matters can hardly be in doubt. The issue is not whether culture matters, but how does culture matter? Also, we have to recognize with clarity that cultural identification can not only inform and enlighten, it can also deceive and distort. I've already discussed in the two previous lectures some of the problems associated with relying too heavily on cultural or so-called civilizational categories. First, important as culture is, it's not uniquely significant in determining our lives and identities. Other things such as class, race, gender, profession, politics also matter, and can matter powerfully. Regarding identity, as was discussed in the earlier lectures, we do not just discover our identity. We recognize there are very alternative claimants to our loyalty, and we have to choose the weights and emphasis to be put on different parts of our identity, different versions of our identity. Second, culture is not a homogeneous attribute. There can be great variations even within the same general cultural milieu. Cultural determinists often underestimate the extent of heterogeneity within what is taken to be one culture. Discordant voices are often internal rather than coming from outside. Indeed, as we read about even from Kabul and Kandahar, it's remarkable how much quiet, unexpressed, but nevertheless firm disagreement and dissent there was. Also, depending on the particular aspect of culture, we decide to concentrate on, for example, whether we focus on religion or literature or on music, we can get quite a varying picture of the internal and external relations involved. Third, culture does not sit still. Any presumption of stationarity, explicit or implicit, can be disastrously deceptive. The temptations towards using cultural determinism often takes the hopeless form of trying to moor the cultural anchor on the deck of a rapidly moving boat. Finally, cultures interact and are typically not rigidly isolated structures. The presumption of insularity, often implicitly invoked, can be deeply delusive. However, taking all this into account, and I wanted to put them first on the picture, after taking all this into account, if culture is seen to be non-homogeneous, non-static and interactive, and if the importance of culture is integrated with rival sources of influence, on the relative importance of which we have some decision to exercise, then, I would argue, culture can be a very positive and constructive part of our understanding of human behavior and identity. Let me scrutinize these issues a bit more. In the last lecture in November, I took the liberty of quoting a passage from Samuel Huntington's introductory essay called Culture's Count in a volume of essays called Culture Matters. Since I cited Huntington's argument more than 2 months ago, I should perhaps remind you of the passage. That's one of the problems of giving 6 lectures spread over a very long number of months. So let me remind you what the quotation in fact was. This is from Huntington. In the early 1990s, I happened to come across economic data on Ghana and South Korea in the early 1960s. And I was astonished to see how similar their economies were then. 30 years later, South Korea had become an industrial giant with the 14th largest economy in the world, multinational corporation, major exports of automobiles, electronic equipment, and other sophisticated manufacturers, and per capita income approximately that of Greece. Moreover, it was on its way to the consolidation of democratic institutions. No such changes had occurred in Ghana, whose per capita income was now about 1/15 that of South Korea's. How would this extraordinary difference in development be explained? Undoubtedly, many factors played a role, but it seemed to me that culture had to be a large part of the explanation. South Koreans valued thrift, investment, hard work, education, organization, and discipline. Ghanaians had different values. In short, cultures count. Unquote. There is indeed something of interest in this engaging comparison. And yet, as used here, the contrast is extremely deceptive. There were very many important differences between Ghana and Korea, other than cultural predispositions. First, the class structures were quite different, with a bigger role of business classes, much bigger role in South Korea. Second, the politics were very different too, with the government in South Korea willing and eager to play a prime moving role in initiating a business-centered economic development in a way that it did not apply to Ghana. Third, the close relationship between the Korean economy on the one hand and the Japanese economy and the United States on the other made a big difference too, at least in the early stages of Korean development. Fourth, and perhaps most important, by the 1960s, South Korea had already acquired a much higher literacy rate and a much more expanded school system than Ghana had. The Korean changes had been brought about in the post-Second World War period, beginning from the late 1940s, largely through resolute public policy, governmental action, and it could not be seen just as a reflection of age-old Korean culture. On the basis of the slender scrutiny offered, it's hard to justify either the cultural triumphalism in favor of Korean culture, or the radical pessimism about Ghana's future that the reliance on cultural determinism would definitely tend to suggest. Neither can be derived from the over-rapid and under-analyzed comparison that accompanies the heroic diagnostics. There have, of course, been various earlier attempts at cultural determinism and even cultural privileging in explaining economic development. Indeed, a century ago, Max Weber, the great sociologist, had presented a major thesis on the decisive role of Protestant ethics in the successful development of a capitalist industrial economy. Weberian analysis of the role of culture in the emergence of capitalism drew on the world as he had observed it in the late 19th century. It is of particular dialectical interest in the contemporary world, in light especially of the recent success of market economies in non-Protestant and even non-Christian societies. In fact, in sharp contrast with Max Weber's analysis of Protestant ethics, many writers in present-day Asia emphasize the role of Confucian ethics in the success of industrial and economic progress in East Asia. There have, in fact, been several different theories seeking explanation of the high performance of East Asian economies in terms of local culture there. Michio Morishima, a great economist and a former colleague of mine at LSE, has traced the roots of the Japanese ethos, to which he attributes the difference and the great success of Japan and East Asia, the roots of Japanese ethos to the special history of its feudal system. Ronald Dorr, a great sociologist, has emphasized the contribution, as I was mentioning, of Confucian ethics. Eiko Ikegami, a brilliant young Japanese historian, has focused on the influence on the samurai code of honor. There is indeed much to learn from these theories, but it is remarkable how the cultural explanations have often foundered, you see, drawn on the basis of history, have often foundered in light of later observations. Indeed, these theories have often been one step behind the actual world. By the time Max Weber's privileging of Protestant ethics based on 19th century experience was getting widely recognized and accepted, many of the Catholic countries, including France and Italy, were beginning to grow faster than Protestant Britain or Germany. The thesis had to be then altered, and the privileged culture was taken more generally to be Christian and Western, rather than specifically Protestant. However, by the time that Eurocentric view of the culture of development got established, Japan was growing much faster than the West. So Japan had to be included in the privileged category, and there was useful work on the role of Japanese ethos, samurai culture, and so on. But by the time the specialness of Japan was well understood, the Eastern Asian economies were growing very fast, and there was a need to broaden the theory of Japan's specialness to include the wider coverage of Confucian ethics and a more spacious regional tradition. But by the time that Confucian theory had become well established, the fastest growing economy in the world was Thailand, which is a Buddhist country. Indeed, Japan, Korea, China, and Taiwan too have much Buddhist influence in their culture. The grand cultural theories have a propensity to trail one step behind the world of practice, rather than serving as a grand predictive device. This record, I should emphasize, need not be seen as one of embarrassment, since we have learned something from a closer understanding of the cultural linkages emerging from these specialized studies. But the attempt to view culture as a singular, stationary, and independent source of development has not been crowned with success. What is needed is not cultural determinism, but the integration of culture in a wider picture in which culture, seen in a dynamic and interactive way, is one important influence among many others. When I was thinking about that, I was reminded of an old novel, which I don't think many people read, once very famous, by Edith Wharton, called Zingu, where she caricatures one of her characters called Mrs. Ballinger. And Edith Wharton's caricature goes like this: Mrs. Ballinger was one of those ladies who pursue culture in bands as if it is dangerous to meet culture alone, unquote. What I'm arguing is that those cautious ladies were absolutely right. It is indeed dangerous to meet culture alone. Culture must be seen firmly in company. While culture does not work in isolation from other social influences, once we place culture in adequate company, it can then greatly help to eliminate our understanding of the world, including the process of development and the nature of our identity. Let me refer again to South Korea, which was a much more literate and more educated society than Ghana was in the 1960s, when the two economies appeared rather similar to Huntington. The contrast, as was already mentioned, was very substantially the result of public policies pursued in South Korea in the decade, just the preceding decades after the Second World War, and this, of course, had no parallel in Ghana. And yet, and this is where we have to broaden the picture, public policies on education were very likely partly influenced by antecedent cultural features as well, just as subsequent cultural features were also influenced by education. Education has a two-way relation with culture. On the one hand, education influences culture very deeply, and on the other, education itself is influenced both by political and social policies and by the interrelation of these policies with existing cultural characteristics. So we need a much more complex interactive analysis. It is, for example, remarkable, just to quote one fact, that nearly every country in the world with a powerful presence of Buddhist tradition has tended to embrace widespread schooling and literacy with some eagerness. This applied not only to Japan and to Korea, but also to China and Thailand and Sri Lanka. Indeed, even miserable Burma, with a dreadful record of political oppression and social tyranny, still has a higher rate of literacy than its neighbor in the subcontinent, India or Pakistan. Seen in a broader framework, there is probably something here to investigate and learn from. Given the importance that is attached in Buddhist theory to the ability of people to read religious and philosophical discourses, there is even a prima facie motivational connection here that can be cogently examined and critically scrutinized. Indeed, one of Buddha's major criticisms of Hinduism in his time was that the scriptures were in Sanskrit, which were by then inaccessible to the common people in India. I might say that 2,500 years later, the scriptures are still in Sanskrit. To be sure, the cultural eagerness to expand basic education does not act on its own, and it requires public policy to make rapid expansion possible. It is therefore extremely important to see the interactive nature of the process in which contact with other countries and the knowledge of their experience, their understanding of their experience, can make a big motivational difference. There's every evidence that when Korea decided to move briskly forward with school education at the end of the Second World War, it was to a great extent influenced by a new understanding of and focus on the experience of both Japan in its neighborhood and the West, including the United States. To a great extent, these interactions also led to recharacterization of how people saw themselves, thereby redefining the content of what it is to be an Asian or an East Asian. Cultural interrelations within a broad framework does indeed provide a useful focus for our understanding. It contrasts, on the one hand, with neglecting culture altogether, as some economic models do, and on the other, with the privileging of culture in stationary and isolated terms, as is frequently done in social models of cultural determinism. We must, I would argue, we go well beyond both. As the Japanese illustration exemplifies, cultural developments are often strongly influenced by cultural interactions across borders. I want to devote the rest of this lecture to the importance of these interactions. In that context, I must also examine the presumption of cultural separatism that seems to have, if only implicitly, taken substantial roots in influential parts of cultural studies. And let me discuss this separatism a bit more. Even the possibility of cross-cultural communication is forcefully denied in some versions of radical distancing of culture that many theorists advance. As Partha Chatterjee describes this drastic position, I should explain, it's not his own, his is a somewhat moderate version of this. I quote, "Each culture could have its distinctive system of logic, which would make the beliefs held by people in that culture thoroughly incommensurable with beliefs held in other cultures," unquote. You often see that type of thought expressed very powerfully in cultural studies as well as anthropological discourses. In my first lecture in this series, I did briefly discuss the methodological predicament, indeed, I believe, absurdity, in which we have to end up if we must insist on seeing the large world as being split up into a cluster of little islands which are not within intellectual reach of each other. This does not, of course, deny the possibility that what appears to me to be a good reason to do something may not appear to you to be so at all. And this can, in fact, happen even if we live in the same society and possibly even belong to the same family. But differences in substantive reasoning is very different from the most spectacular claim that, to quote Chatterjee's explanation again, what seems to us to be an intelligible reason for acting may not be so for others, unquote. The absence of intelligibility would be a truly drastic mental limitation, quite different from a mere disagreement on what makes a reason a good reason. I discussed in the first lecture why there is hardly any plausible evidence that such failures of intelligibility inescapably occur. In the second lecture, I also discussed the diversity of influences with varying geographical origins that can be seen even within the limits of what is taken to be one basic culture of civilization. For example, while the so-called Western civilization is often taken to be an entirely endogenous development, thoroughly immaculate in conception, the evidence of extensive influences from other cultures, Arabic, Chinese, Indian, and many others, are manifest in the intellectual foundations of Western science, technology, and mathematics. I did discuss that in the second lecture. It is important to be clear about human intelligibility across cultures, and also about the actual and constructive impact that cultural interaction across borders have. But I now want to go one step beyond that and discuss the evidence that cross-cultural interactions can be the result of reasoned cultivation of such interaction rather than mere serendipity. Historically, people have not only had extensive intercultural interactions throughout history, they have also often enough consciously sought such interactions. Indeed, the Charter Oath to which I referred earlier, proclaimed in Japan in 1868, which declared the firm intention to seek knowledge widely throughout the world, quote-unquote, is a good example of just such a conscious search. It is interesting and important to know the reasons that have led people to look for more, the different reasons that have led people to look for more intercultural contacts and to understand the discernible benefits that have been anticipated and very often realized from such relations. Indeed, many different kinds of benefits seem to have been expected, and I shall briefly discuss a few of the distinct rewards for which intercultural interactions have been cultivated. I shall not, however, deal, and I hear it's a disclaimer, I shall not deal with some well-known reasons for seeking cross-border contacts which are not aimed specifically at cross-cultural communication and interchange, even though such communication and interchange may result indirectly from them. I shall not discuss, for example, voyages of conquest, of raiders as well as empire builders. Conquerors such as Alexander did bring about major intercultural interactions. Indeed, in the centuries following Alexander, there was a remarkable flowering of Southern Asian art, sculpture, theater, and other cultural activity based on interactions between Indian and Greek traditions, including the development of the famous Gandhara school of Buddhist sculpture, of which the large Bamiyan Buddha was one of the ones that was blown off not long ago in Afghanistan. Incidentally, the term Gandhara, from which Kandahar is derived, is the Sanskrit name for the third of the seven basic notes of Indian classical music. However, despite Alexander's great curiosity about Indian and other cultures, for a general, he spent an incredible amount of time chatting on Indian philosophy in between battling around. The massive interaction that followed Alexander's conquest were not, of course, part of the conscious objective that Alexander had actually pursued. Nor shall I examine religious travel and migration, including those of pilgrimage, or for missionary activities aimed at conversion, or at philanthropy, or humanitarian assistance. Nor shall I take up the big issue of migration, which is motivated by a great many distinct and disparate causes, some more horrendous than others, as Sebastiano Salgado's wonderful photographs have brought out on migration, have brought out in stark and moving form. Nor shall I have the opportunity to consider contact across borders for reasons of trade, exchange, and economic gain. These are cases where cultural things went with trade, migration, conquest, and so on, but they were not. It's not communication, intercultural interaction that were being consciously sought in that. It's the consciousness which I want to look at. I shall instead concentrate only on the reasons for specifically seeking intercultural interaction. Why have such contact been directly and consciously sought? In particular, I shall comment on the following motives, though there are clearly others, which could have been also discussed, but I shall confine myself to three. One, learning from each other and advancing one's knowledge. Two, understanding each other and thereby reducing cross-cultural violence and conflict. Three, seeking distant perspectives as a way of avoiding local parochialism. Learning from others is among the most obvious reasons for seeking out intercultural communication and contact. In previous lectures, I've talked about extensive interactions in science, engineering, mathematics, literature, arts, as part of the history of the world. Indeed, the history of the world includes plentiful examples of people deliberately trying to learn from others elsewhere. Professor Fromkin's own work on the history of the world brings this out. I shall not engage in illustrating and explicating different examples of such search, but will comment on a few general issues. One general issue concerns the relevance of a much-discussed issue in anthropology and anthropology influence social sciences, the relevance of local knowledge. In recent works in cultural studies, there have often been much championing of the importance of local knowledge. This is, I think, to a great extent just right, since local knowledge, especially in less prosperous countries, often in dominated countries in the age of imperialism, has often been underappreciated, partly because of imperial arrogance and the inequalities of power balance in the world, but also because the increasing trend toward globalization of knowledge, which tends to favor reverence for pervasive rather than confined acumen. And yet there is also the opposite danger, that of getting imprisoned in an unargued belief in the magnificence of local knowledge. Uncritical acceptance of the greatness of local knowledge, especially in deprived regions in the world, of course serves many social and political functions. But local beliefs, no less than global beliefs, have to be subject to critical scrutiny. While some may come through in flying colors in epistemological scrutiny, others could quite possibly fail in a small or in a big way. Also, there can be scope for global learning from local knowledge, and there is no irresistible reason why local wisdom, like the Italian wine Frascati from the Lazio region, should ideally be drunk only locally. Consider the important fact that techniques of inoculation and vaccination were developed in various forms in a number of societies in Asia and Africa well before Edward Jenner, the British physician, developed the standard vaccination against smallpox in 1798. These indigenous experiences of local knowledge, these achievements of Africa and Asia, have been seen as excellent examples of neglected local achievements, and so indeed they were. They certainly deserve to be remembered and celebrated. But questions about the relative effectiveness, social as well as medical, of different approaches to vaccination and inoculation are also appropriate to ask. And even though local techniques may often be shown to have many special merits, as they often do, they can also be quite limited in reach, effectiveness, and safety. For example, it would be hard to deny that until the work of Jenner and others 200 years ago, the medical effectiveness and safety of vaccination and inoculation had remained quite problematic. We must not fall for the temptation to jump from admiration for early science to adoration of local knowledge as a source of superior wisdom. A second problem concerns the global relevance of local knowledge. It would be wrong to overlook the creative impact that local knowledge may have when it spreads beyond its locality, when it finds global expression. For example, the African and Asian experiences of inoculation were getting known in Europe and America throughout the 18th century, preceding the Jenner scientific breakthrough. Cotton Mather, here in Boston, one of the early figures associated with Harvard, learned from his slave, Onesimus, about the African experience of inoculation in 1706, nearly 100 years before Jenner's definitive demonstration. And Mather went on to publicize that fact. I should mention, incidentally, since I mentioned also that one has to look at the nature of what was being claimed, Onesimus explained to Mather that there is a technique whereby you introduce some vector into the body, and that makes you forever free from the contagion of smallpox. But Onesimus also added that the technique carried dangers too, and its use requires some courage. I think that's the factor to emphasize, both the achievement as well as the limitation. Indeed, the work of Jenner and others drew on a European intellectual climate that was receptive and open, as indeed many other things I discussed in the second lecture were, and in which there were many global influences of local knowledge through a powerful interactive process. An isolationist view of local knowledge can both, on one, privilege it too much by arbitrarily dispensing with the need for close critical scrutiny, and to undermine its extensive significance by insisting on its immutable localness, thereby neglecting its global relevance. A second issue concerns the fact that knowledge that people seek from other societies and cultures may sometimes specifically be about the local features of that society and culture. We may be keen not only to learn from other cultures, but also to learn about other cultures. Our intellectual interest need not be confined only to general scientific and technological knowledge, but may reflect our curiosity about each other. Indeed, the great travelers of the world undertook many of their journeys specifically with such objectives in mind. One thinks, of course, of Marco Polo. But there are a great many other such explorers, hundreds, who went to see very far how others lived and came back to tell their compatriots what they found. Given the nature of the subject matter, it's interesting to see, particularly in view of the earlier discussion in this lecture, how these travelers distinguished between intelligibility of other people's reasons needed for effective intercultural understanding and acceptability of those reasons, which is quite a different issue with which intelligibility is sometimes confused in a way it should not be. Consider, for example, Ibn Battuta, who was born in Tangier in 1304, and he spent 30 years in various travels in Africa and Asia. He liked some things he saw, and he hated others. He found various things that were entirely intelligible to him, but by no means approvable. The distinction which I was trying to make, I can make with quoting from this 14th century writer. For example, in Iwaltan, which is perched between Ghana and Mali, in fact not far from Timbuktu, Ibn Battuta befriended the Qadi, but was totally shocked by his behavior. Here is what Battuta says about the event. I quote from Battuta. "One day I went into the presence of the Qadi of Iwaltan, after asking his permission to enter, and found him with a young and remarkably beautiful woman. When I saw her and wished to withdraw, but she laughed at me and experienced no shyness. The Qadi said to me, 'Why are you turning back? She is my friend.' I was amazed at their behavior." Unquote. But Qadi was not the only one that shocked Battuta, and he was particularly censorious of Abu Mahmud Yanda Khan al-Musufi, who had earlier on actually visited Battuta's Morocco himself. When Battuta visited him at his house, he found a woman conversing with a man seated on a couch. Battuta reports, I quote from Battuta, "I said to him, 'Who is this woman?' He said, 'She is my wife.' I said, 'What connection has the man with her?' He replied, 'He is her friend.' I said to him, 'Do you acquiesce in this when you have lived in our country and become acquainted with the precepts of the Shah?' He replied, 'The association of women with men is agreeable to us and a part of good conduct to which no suspicion attaches. They are not like the woman of your country.' Continuing still with Battuta, I was astonished at his laxity. I left him and did not return thereafter. He invited me several times, but I did not accept, unquote. Indeed, even Battuta went from country to country and methodically distinguished between, as he explained, what I approve and what I disapproved. Disapproval is quite different from unintelligibility. In fact, a fair amount of intelligibility is necessary to see and formulate a reason for disapproval. The confounding of the two, which is so, I believe, rampant in cultural studies and even in some postcolonial writing, is not only a conceptual mistake in itself. That mistake can serve as the basis of a misconceived perception that the world in which we live is inescapably split into little isolated islands that are not within the reach of one another's thoughts. I turn now to the second motivation for consciously seeking intercultural communication and interchange. The belief that ignorance is at the root of the common suspicion of foreigners has often figured in the literature on conflict. I can give many examples, but the thesis was extraordinarily powerfully presented more than 1,000 years ago by Al-Biruni, an Iranian born in Central Asia in 973 AD, who wrote in Arabic and authored a classic book on Indian civilization, concentrating particularly on science, culture, and mathematics. Al-Biruni was a mathematician, a very distinguished one, by the way, whose first visit to India was an extremely bloody one, when he came to India with the invading army of Sultan Mahmud of Ghazni. And Al-Biruni recorded his revulsion at the atrocities committed by the barbaric invader whom he was accompanying. But while Sultan Mahmud went back, Al-Biruni stayed on and got very involved with India, proceeded to master Sanskrit, studied Indian texts on mathematics, natural sciences, literature, philosophy, and religion, conversed with as many experts as he could get hold of, and also observed social conventions and practice. As a mathematician, Al-Biruni's primary interest was, of course, in Indian mathematics. He also produced a better Arabic translation of Brahmagupta's famous Sanskrit treatise on mathematics and astronomy, first translated into Arabic in the 8th century. Al-Biruni thought it was a bad translation, so he retranslated it. Al-Biruni's book on India presents a remarkable account of the intellectual traditions and social customs of early 11th century India. In explaining the motivation for the book, Al-Biruni argued that it is very important for people in one country to know how others elsewhere live and how and what they think. Evil behavior, Al-Biruni's theory was, can arise from a lack of understanding of and familiarity with other people. I must say that such has been the dominance of the idea that all this came with the Enlightenment, that whenever I've read out the passages without saying the author, it has always appeared to people to be European thought rather than early 11th century thought by an Iranian visiting India. I quote Al-Biruni, "In all manners and usages, the Indians differ from us to such a degree as to frighten their children with us, with our dress and our ways and customs, and as to declare us to be devil's breed and our doings as the very opposite of all that is good and proper. By the way, we must confess, in order to be just, that a similar depreciation of foreigners not only prevail among us and the Indians, but is common to all nations towards each other." Not a bad thought for 1020. Given the general motivation, Al-Biruni explained in the concluding chapter of his book what he had aimed to do in the book, aside from, of course, maths, etc. Al-Biruni, like many others, Al-Khwarizmi, which I quoted earlier, of course, had a major impact in the connection between Indian and Arabic mathematics and then later to the European too. But here he's explaining why he wrote the book. "We think now that what we have related in this book will be sufficient for anyone who wants to converse with the Indians and to discuss with them questions of religion, of science, of literature, on the very basis of their own civilization, unquote. That theme recurs in world history, even when it is not presented with such clarity. Indeed, as the reach of globalization began to expand dramatically in the 18th century, the ethical gain from greater knowledge of each other received explicit acknowledgement in European writings as well. While commenting on the importance of increased intercourse in expanding the reach of our sense of justice, David Hume noted in 1770s, I quote from, it's actually one of his last works just before he died, a quote from Hume, "Again, suppose that several distinct societies maintain a kind of intercourse for mutual convenience and advantage. The boundaries of justice will grow larger in proportion to the largeness of men's views and the force of their mutual connections," unquote. The thesis of Al-Biruni and Hume remain as relevant today as they were when they were articulated. If knowing more about foreigners help us to avoid conflict with them and even to include them within the domain of our ethical concern, as Hume emphasized, there is also a different argument that sees the foreigners not as objects of study, but as subjects whose perspectives can help us to subdue our own parochialism. It's actually a rather sophisticated thought, and the one who discusses it very well is Adam Smith. Adam Smith himself, though interested in accounts of travel of others, greatly interested, was not a great traveler himself. But he argued that we have to place ourselves very firmly outside our own surroundings, our own local culture, to get an adequate, impartial understanding what morality and justice demand. This is, in fact, became, of course, a part of the general program of invoking the impartial spectator, of which Smith made such extensive use, and I'm going to come back to in the, not the next fourth lecture, but the fifth lecture in April, which is about identity and ethics. Smith explained the need for such deliberate use of distancing. I quote from Smith, "We can never survey our own sentiments and motives. We can never form any judgment concerning them unless we remove ourselves, as it were, from our own natural station and endeavor to view them as at a certain distance from us. But we can do this in no other way than by endeavoring to view them with the eyes of other people, as other people are likely to view them," unquote. For example, Adam Smith, as an example, as an illustration, invokes, quote unquote, "the eyes of the rest of mankind to understand and determine," I quote, "whether a punishment is equitable," unquote. That thought, in fact, has an uncanny relevance today. Whether we think of the penal codes of the Taliban, or for that matter, the easy acceptance of capital punishment on this side of the Atlantic, or indeed the way prisoners in the Guantanamo Bay might be treated, and the whole issue comes in as to whether viewing it as it would appear from elsewhere would not be a necessary part of justice. But no matter what the substantive uses of the Smithian procedure is, its great methodological reach would be very hard to ignore. Far from cultures being non-communicating islands, a view of communitarian separatism with which I began, we may exactly need cross-cultural communication even to understand the fairness or justice of established practice in one land in light of how it would appear to impartial spectators at a distance. Smith was, of course, a quintessential Enlightenment theorist. But the general soliciting of distant views was not by any means unique to or invented by European Enlightenment. It has recurred again and again in history. For example, Akbar, the Mughal emperor of India, to whom I referred, and I discussed him quite a bit in my first lecture, was very clearly aware of the need for invoking distant perspectives to understand what would be the proper thing to do. When he arranged intercultural and interreligious discussions in Agra in late 16th century, he not only included Hindu and Muslim mainstream scholars in India, and Jains, also fairly mainstream, but also Christians, including Jesuits, Parsis, Jews, and atheists. The acceptance, and to some extent even the celebration, of the alleged unbridgeability of cultural distancing that is so prevalent in contemporary cultural theory contrasts sharply with the seeking and welcoming of distant perspectives that many practitioners as well as theorists have emphasized in the past. I must end here today. In this lecture, the third in the series, I have talked generally about the role of culture in our understanding, behavior, and self-perception. Aside from placing culture in its context, related to other influences on our identity, my focus has particularly been on the constructive role of intercultural interactions. Beginning with disputing the often articulated view of cultures as isolated islands, not within intelligent reach of each other, I have discussed how intelligibility is a totally different condition from approval. The history of cultures is to a great extent the history of interaction between cultures. I've also discussed some of the reasons for which interaction between cultures have been systematically sought in the past, and why these reasons, such as acquiring of knowledge, prevention of conflict and violence, avoidance of parochialism, remain as relevant today as they have been in the past.
You've been listening to a lecture by visiting professor and Nobel Prize winner in economics, Amartya Sen, of Boston University's Pardee Center for the Study of the Longer Range Future. For a cassette of Boston University's World of Ideas, call 1-800-909-9287. That's 1-800-909-9287. Cassettes are $15 and include shipping and handling. To learn more about Boston University's World of Ideas, visit our website at buwi.org. Tonight's program was produced by Tina Tobey, with help from Vince Fairchild, John Hoder, and Mike Toda. Our web producer is Angel Cazelli. I'm Ted O'Brien. Thanks for joining us.
This is WBUR Boston.